So, now I will introduce our main speaker, Mary.
Good morning. My name is Mary. I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a product of countless vain attempts. I want to thank Patty and the committee for using such good judgment in getting these wonderful speakers up here. And I'm particularly grateful that it isn't a contest, that we're not in competition. Also, I would like to welcome those new people who stood and those who did not. And if you were here last night and you're here this morning wondering if you are an alcoholic, that's like a virgin going to the doctor asking for a rabbit test. There's some indication that you might be. So just keep coming back. This morning, during my meditation, I opened my curtains in my room, and I was looking over this beautiful pond with the ducks and the geese out there, and I was thinking how wonderful it was that those ducks and geese can accept just what they are and just sort of glide along on that water and be so serene and peaceful. And it reminded me of a lot of the old-timers I know that seem to be serene and peaceful, like those ducks and geese just gliding across the water. And then I remember that, you know, if you look under the water, the feet are going like hell. I guess I better tell you about my drinking. And I can wrap it all up by quoting what the cat said when he got through making love to the skunk. He said, "I didn't get all I wanted, but I got all I could stand." And from what I've heard, that's happened to several of you. I don't know anything about social drinking either. I was struck by what Johnny said last night. In fact, I was very touched by John's talk last night in the purity and the simplicity of his message. And, you know, I was thinking, God, it's a damn good thing he wasn't educated because, you know, some of these intellects, we lose them. May have saved his life. But I was thinking about when he was on that airplane with that woman with a double martini by her side, which reminded me of a time when I went over to my brother's house after I'd been sober a few years, and he had about five people there. It was Christmas, and I went over with an AA buddy, and I guess it's my attitude, too, because the first woman I saw there was a little old lady, and she had a tall, anemic drink with ice and all that kind of stuff on it, you know, mix and everything, and she was sipping that drink, and she was tiddly. I wanted to belt her in the mouth, you know. And then when I got in there, you know, I saw a guy put his drink down on a table and leave that drink there unattended while he went into the next room, and that still makes me nervous to this day. Then when I went into the kitchen where my sister-in-law was stirring something on the stove, I saw the supply. I say there's about five or six people drinking. There was a pint on the table with the lid on it. And there was a jigger on its side. I'm ashamed to say that one. And so my brother came in and he said, "Connie, would you like to have another drink?" You know what she said? "No, thanks. I'm beginning to feel mine." How do you like that, you newcomers? And they were talking about eating. Jesus. Eating. Well, see, I don't know anything about drinking like that, if you call that drinking. I don't know whether I was born an alcoholic, but I'll tell you one thing. When I drank my first drink, an alcoholic was born. because my drink, too, like Johanna's, was slow gin. And I thought, you know, that was... I was kind of ashamed to admit that it was slow gin, because that isn't the in drink. When I see a young gal like that talking about slow gin, it's not so bad. It was, you know, I always figured, you know, that's not an in drink, and it dates me, which it does. Because I drank that first drink, and then I drank some more, and I threw up and passed out and figured that's part of the deal. And when I talk about slow gin, as I say, it dates me, and I'm thinking lately about getting one of those facelifts that all the gals are getting, or not all of them, but a lot of them are, you know. And then on sober reflection, I say, well, what's the point in getting a facelift when everything else is sagging 2 inches below where it used to, you know? God, I mean, it's a sad day when you're trying on one of those cross-your-knees bras. Thank God they told me about acceptance here. But at the time I was introduced to the elixir, I was in show business. I was a featured dancer. I had left home when the day after I graduated from high school to set the world on fire with my talent. And anyway, I was on this road show, and I can't say that I became a daily drunk. It seemed to me, though, that I never was able to predict my conduct, and I always seemed to overshoot the field. I never really planned getting as drunk as I did, but I seemed to get there somehow or another. And I was able to drink great quantities for a long time. My big thing was I could drink any guy under the table. But anyway, after that road show, I wound up in your territory here, folks. I became a featured dancer in the nightclubs of San Francisco and El Cerrito and Berkeley and Sacramento some years ago. Oh, God, I mean, it's 40 years and 40 pounds ago, folks. Anyway, when I was in this area and I was being written up in Herb Kane's column as the Belle of Bush Street, not what Eddie Cochran calls me, but I had it made according to those who viewed me from the outside, because I had the band playing exactly the way I wanted it. I was wearing fancy clothes. I had a fancy pad over in San Francisco. I had a lot of attention from the men. And I was table hopping every night, giving everybody a break, you understand. And I walked around with this empty feeling, wondering why I wasn't happy. I had some unfulfilled thing in my gut here that I never could identify. And then I said to myself, well, when Hollywood discovers me, that will be the answer to this unanswered question that I've lived with all of my life. And of course, like the others that you've heard, I was sensitive, and I was dramatic, and a perfectionist, and all those things. And most of all, I was scared. And I didn't even know that I was scared until my sponsor told me I was. But anyway, the day came when I was offered the opportunity to go down to Southern California and take a screen test. And I went down there with the attitude that Betty Davis had better start saving her money, because I was on my way. And I went down there and took the screen test, and it was rotten. Now, how can you act when you're already acting? But I didn't know that at the time. However, they did sign me to a stock contract, which means that you're just part of the herd. You're no big deal. But anyway, I became part of the herd and immediately got caught up with the drinking crowd. And, I know how these newcomers feel when they say, God, what am I going to tell my friends? They all drink. Well, of course we do. We don't hang around people that don't drink. But I didn't know that. So, you know, I made all the fancy nightclubs and supper clubs and reverted to my role as a playgirl. And did very little in pictures. I did a few little bits and danced and some of those things. Nothing, no biggie. And in the back of my mind, I was thinking, God, you know, my career. such as it was going nowhere, and I started to get a little uneasy about it. And after about 2 years at that studio, a man from the USO office came and offered me an opportunity to go overseas and entertain the soldiers. The World War was on at the World War II was on at that time. So I jumped at the chance, because the first thing that came to my mind was all those men over there and all the attention I was going to get, because I was used to a lot of attention and I wasn't getting it at that studio. So I went over there, presenting fierce patriotism, of course. And it seems strange to me now that I know something about alcoholism that I didn't get the clues along the way. And, of course, one of the big clues is defending your right to drink. Now, if there's any of you guys that were overseas during that war and still harbor a little resentment about USO girls fraternizing only with the officers, I want to tell you I was very democratic with my drinking. I drank with Yardbirds, Generals. It didn't make any difference to me. I never said what, I just said where, and let's go. I got in a lot of trouble because on this tour, we went to China, Burma, and India. And this occasion that I'm about to tell you about happened when we were high in the Himalaya Mountains someplace, and can't remember the name of the place. And I had been drinking grapefruit juice and something with the guys the night before, and who cared? And I came to, and I couldn't move. I was paralyzed, and my eyelids were fluttering, I suppose. And a very famous movie star was my roommate, and she noticed that she was also my drinking buddy. And she noticed there was something terribly wrong with me, so she went and got the medics, and they came trooping in, and they gave me shots and oxygen, and I don't know what all, but they worked on me for 2 hours just to get me on my feet and functioning again. And you know, I blame the altitude. I had myself so well sold on the idea that I couldn't drink in altitudes. I didn't even drink in Denver after that. I just knew that I couldn't drink in altitudes. And I came back from that tour, and I felt very put upon because the military had not told us that they expected us to entertain between shows. Well, actually, they hadn't put that demand on us at all. That demand came from me. Because, you see, I was one of those who desperately needed approval, and I couldn't say no to anything. And that's where I got into all my trouble all the time. And one of the big gifts of freedom that I've gotten from this program is the fact that today I can live in a manner that's acceptable to me regardless of public opinion. And that's a long time, long way for me to come. See, while I was playing all those parts and wearing all those masks so you would approve of me, I was throwing away my own approval, and that's the one I needed the most and didn't know how to get. And so I was offered the opportunity this time of going over to the European theater. And I thought to myself, as chapter 3 says, this time it's going to be different. This time I'm not going to get involved in all those parties. This time I'll just drink a little bit and mind my P's and Q's and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And this time it was different. It was worse. Because I didn't know how not to get involved in those things. And so I did get into a lot of trouble in the European theater in that you're probably looking at the only USO girl that was ever up for court-martial. Because I was a bad drunk. And the reason I was up for court-martial, I will tell you now, because I always tell this story. I still have my illusions and my dreams. See, I was always madly in love. Either that or recovering from love, and I don't know which I enjoyed the most. You know, when you I was sober for 3 years before I knew the difference between being in love and in heat. The difference you know, when you're recovering from love, and I'm sure there are others in here that did the same thing I did, you get out that sad music, you know. And you get the jug out, right? And you start reminiscing about the tender, romantic moments. And you edit out all the crap. Right? God, I used to love that bittersweet agony, you know. I used to love the music that had no hope to it whatsoever. Like the man who got away, God. I used to love that. But anyway, I fell in love with a very handsome lieutenant over there. During a drinking party, of course. And I had traveled some towns beyond where I had first met this man, and I was madly in love. And here I was involved again in another drinking party, and I suddenly decided that I needed to get in touch with this man. And I got on one of those field telephones. And, you know, sometimes it takes 5-10 minutes to make a connection. And I was just about to make the connection when this captain, who was also drinking, leaned over the desk and asked me to go drink or play or whatever the hell it was. And I, very dramatically, I'm sure, because I was always very dramatic, told him that I was trying to contact my great love. And he made a big mistake, this captain. He took his thumb and disconnected the phone. And I said, "Captain, if you do that once more, I'm going to hit you." And you know, he didn't believe me. Because I just about got through again, and he disconnected again. And since I had the phone in my hand, I whacked him on the ear as hard as I could. Inadvertently, I like to say. And so he didn't know what happened. Either he was so loaded or stunned or whatever it was. He didn't know what happened for a few seconds, but he must have seen some look of horror come on my face. And that look came from seeing the blood gush out of his ear and out his white trench coat. And when he saw that, he screamed like a banshee and ran across the street to where the MPs were hostled and signed out all these complaints, and they all came trooping over, and he pointed me out and he said, "That's the one." And so I was ordered, since I was under military orders, I was ordered to appear the next morning at 10 o'clock. Spent the rest of the night trying to figure out how I was going to get out of this one. So since there were 14 girls on the show, I decided that if I took two of the other brunettes with me, that there was an outside chance he wouldn't be able to identify me. And so we showed up at the hearing at 10 o'clock, and there was that poor captain. He was sitting there with one of those hangovers that come over in waves, you know, with the poached eyes and everything. And he couldn't identify me. Now, I like to tell that story because I have this dream that in looking back, I am quite sure that he was one of us. And that someday, when I'm talking from the podium, I will tell this portion of my story and maybe he'll be in the audience. It might even be this morning. I don't know, see. And after the meeting, he will come up to me with his hand extended and say, "Mary, I'm the one that you hit on the ear in Germany. And I'm going to let him make his amends to me." We weren't always wrong, you know. Even a clock to stop is right twice a day. But, you know, I didn't recognize what was happening to me. I was always in some kind of a bum depression. I was just low all the time. And the booze was not... They took the laughs out of the booze. It wasn't doing it anymore. I was introduced to some speed by the musicians while I was over there, and I was buzzing for days around there. But, you know, anything that would take me from where I was, anything for transportation. And, I tried to recapture the feeling that I once had when I was drinking, and I couldn't do it. But then I blamed man's inhumanity to man because I did not recognize the slow erosion of my spirit that was going on. And I tried to manufacture that feeling, and I tried to pretend it, and I tried to drink it back, and I tried every way I could, and nothing was working. One thing I did know was that if I went back to San Francisco and the Bay Area, everything would be all right again. And one of my philosophies in those days was change conditions and things, and then everything will be all right. The other was, when in doubt, cut out. And so I got back to the United States, and I came back to the Bay Area, and I was working at the Kona Club in El Cerrito. Maybe, I don't know whether any of you remember that or ever there. But everything there seemed to have changed, too, and even the people seemed to have changed. And I thought, God, you know, the war has done some terrible things to people. And I didn't realize what was happening to me. And so, again, it was that emptiness and that not knowing, you know, where, what direction to take. And it was just a kind of a lost wilderness that I was existing in. And I decided I knew what would fix the whole thing. After all, I was about 22 years old, and it was time I settled down and got married. And, you know, I had been everywhere, and I'd done everything, and what's left? And so I carefully selected a victim. It happened to be a bartender I couldn't stand. And I know there's some Al-Anon ladies in there. I always talk, you know, I always give the Al-Anons a lot of juice from the podium because we get some of our best members from there, you know. Anyway, the Al-Anon ladies know that every pot goes out and finds a lid that fits it. Well, this guy didn't drink, which should have been my second clue. I wasn't looking for clues, I was looking for answers. But he didn't drink. He happened to be a compulsive gambler. I'll give you a clue as to what kind of a marriage it was. He was gambling my drinking money, and I drank his gambling money. And I knew right away that, you know, this is going to be a disaster if I didn't straighten him out. And so we took the geographic for each other. Actually, we moved back down to the San Fernando Valley. And I knew that if I got him away from all the damn bookies up here, that, you know, I could shape him up. And I'm quite sure that as sick as he was, that he had the same thought about getting me away from the drinking buddies. And we went down there, and I found a drinking buddy right across the street from our house, and he found some bookies up on the corner, and the race was on again. And God, at this time, I just felt like such a total loser in every department of my life that I was determined to make this marriage work. I couldn't stand losing another one. And so I decided, again, change conditions and things, and the thing for me to do, really, was to have a baby. That would fix everything. And so I got pregnant. Now, my whole illusion, my whole dream of what I was going to be changed. I was going to be the best mother, wife, housekeeper in the world. And I knew that this, I was going to do everything by the numbers, like my neighbors did. You know, they were all wonderful housewives and wonderful women. And, oh, my God, you know, they sing and they got great delight at a clean sink. And I'd never been able to do that, by the way. You know, get this big thrill over of a sparkling kitchen sink, for Christ's sake. I still haven't gotten there. But anyway, I was going to do everything that they did. I was going to wear pink curlers to the market, and I was going to hang my clothes up on Mondays outside and chit-chat over the back fence, and, you know. And I knew that this woman that I wanted to be did not drink. And so I went on the wagon. God, that chokes me up to even use that phrase, you know. Jesus. And I went on the wagon, and God, I got crazier than I ever did drinking because I became a compulsive housekeeper. I used to clean the corners with pins. And I had Q-tips in my pockets at all times to get the little corners under here. There's always one or two others out there. I know that. And I had a toothbrush that I cleaned the lettering on the appliances with, you know. And if the old man got out of bed in the middle of the night to go to the John, his bed was made before he got back. Now, you may think that's a little bit of alcoholic exaggeration, but not really, because I was talking up here one time, and an Al-Anon lady came up to me after the meeting, and she said, "My God, I did all those things that you did," but she said, "I did something you didn't do." And I said, "What's that?" She said, "I used to blow the dust out of the keyholes." See? And I love to hear things like that because that just assures me again that I'm in the right place. See, we're able to talk freely about things we used to hide from ourselves, and that's another freedom. That's another freedom. I can just talk openly. I mean, you ask me a question, brace yourself, because I'll tell you the truth. Because I wouldn't insult you by telling you less than the truth. And so this went on, and when the baby was born, God, it's a wonder I didn't boil that kid, you know. By that time, I was washing the walls with Hexol, and oh my God, it was just pure madness. And that went on for several months. That went on for several months until I found that I was pregnant with the second one. Now, I hadn't planned that one. And you know how that is. I had this first kid's whole life planned, all mapped out, what he was going to be, what schools he was going to, what kind of clothes he was going to wear, what kind of friends I would allow him to have. Everything. And here comes this intruder. And you know, I drank with two attitudes all my life. One was, what's the use? And the other was, I'll show him. And here it was, both of them. What's the use? God knows I've tried. I've become a perfect housekeeper, perfect mother, and there go my plans. Nothing ever works for me. So what's the use? Besides, it's his fault. He's trying to keep me pregnant and barefoot and out in the country. And I can't stand it. So I started drinking again. With my buddy across the street. And, you know, that kind of disillusionment, disappointment, God, it always got me drunk. And especially the resentment was the worst. Because I resented my husband terribly. And it turns out that I really resented myself for, you know, making nickel and dime compromises. I don't have to do that anymore. But anyway, this kind of disillusionment and everything led me right back to my favorite places. The neighborhood bar. I used to love the bars. I was a bar drinker. I loved that unreal atmosphere in there. With the tinkling glasses and the piano and, you know, I used to love, hell, I could walk into a bar with a dollar and stay for 3 days, you know. And you guys that were laughing were picking up my tab, you know. But I loved those guys that were telling me how desirable and intelligent and sexy and all those things that I was. And, you know, it occurred to me that I don't recall ever drinking at a bar with a common laborer. I always drank with nuclear scientists, brain surgeons, those kind of guys, you know. They talk about lower companions, not me. I drank with, you know, the best. The illusions and the dreams and the things. And, you know, that's where I felt comfortable. That shut out reality. Darkness was always unreality, and when I'd walk out of that, have you ever walked out of a bar in the middle of the afternoon and have that sun hit you in the gut? Oh, God, I used to hate that, because that represented reality to me. I didn't want anything to do with reality. I couldn't handle it. And so my husband took a dim view of my activities, and he left me and came back, and then when the baby was born, I continued on. And he left me again and came back. And it was always for the sake of the children. And it was always, I won't gamble so much if you won't drink so much. And we'd make a deal and it would last a few days. And neither one of us knew that we couldn't keep our own promises to ourselves. Never mind anybody else. Because we knew nothing about our compulsive, obsessive personalities. And neither one of us understood the other, of course. And so as a result of one of these joyous reunions, I got pregnant the third time. Now I was outraged womanhood because my alcoholism had taken me from just being a bad drunk to a snarling animal and full of hatred and full of nothingness. And so I don't say this with any great deal of pride, but I was drunk most of the time that I was pregnant with my third child. I don't have to walk around ashamed of that anymore either, because see, I didn't want to be that way, and I didn't have a choice. And I have since learned from people in Alcoholics Anonymous how to treat myself like my own best friend. See, I discovered that I would forgive my best friend for things that I had not yet forgiven myself for. I would treat my best friend a hell of a lot better than I had treated myself. And those are the things that gave me some more freedom. But again, as our lady speaker talked about this morning, my darkest past is my most valuable asset. How am I going to talk to you women, as Fran and I shared last night? How am I going to be able to do that had I not been there? But it went on. It went on, and I was now hopeless and helpless, and I was flopping around my neighborhood like a fish, drinking with the neighbors' husbands. And I wasn't neglecting my children. I abandoned them. And thank God I had neighbors who looked out after them. My mother and father used to come over once in a while, but in my terminal stages of alcoholism, my mother and father did me the biggest favor that anyone could. They didn't even go to Al-Anon, but they turned their backs on me and refused to come over and take care of my children and clean my house and let me go on my merry way. They refused to do that anymore. But I was not able to do anything myself except continue on the downward spiral that we women in Alcoholics Anonymous know. My husband left for the last time, and now I was free to do what I wanted to do and live my life the way I wanted to live, because all those people that were causing all of this were off my back. And now all those things that happen to alcoholic women started happening to me. Those things that I said would never happen to me happened to me. I remember coming to in an alley one cold gray dawn, sick and shaking and scared, and wondering what had become of the great Belle of Bush Street. What had become of all those dreams that I had? And staggering down the street to my home and feeling that every neighbor had their was looking out the window at me. I remember, and I hope I never forget, lurching down Ventura Boulevard one Sunday morning, drunk and staggering and reeling and falling, and coming upon this church where Mass was just letting out, and seeing this family coming down the steps with their two sons. I hope I never forget the look in those, the look of horror in those kids' faces to see this drunken, dirty, reeling woman falling and staggering. See, I didn't want to be there. I hadn't planned on being there. I didn't want to be that. And I was choking on my own disgust and biting back my tears and wishing the earth would swallow me up. And I wasn't through yet. Those other things happened to me too. I don't go into detail about things like that. I don't know whether it's harder to be on the street, because I wasn't in that sense. I wonder if it isn't a little harder to live in suburbia and try to maintain some semblance of respectability. That's very difficult. That's hard. I sponsored a couple of gals that came from Skid Row, and they said, nobody down there gives a damn. And it's easy. I'll tell you, it's tough in suburbia. It is tough in suburbia. It's tough out there when you are asked to come to a PTA meeting, I'll tell you. I was a Cub Scout, mother of Cub Scouts for a couple of years there. That's tough. and try to drink and try to maintain some respectability. That's tough. But I didn't know I was alcoholic. All I knew is that I needed those drinks to quell the tigers that were in my gut. That's the only thing that I had left in this world. And so all those things were happening to me, and I was growing more insane by the moment. And I went to my friendly doctor and told him about the rage and this homicidal rage I had against my husband. And he gave me some pills. Now, that's like changing seats on the Lusitania, you know. But they didn't know that. And I took them in combination with my alcohol, and I became absolutely, totally a raving maniac, determined that I was going to kill this guy if he ever came near me. And I'm sure that I would have had I had the opportunity. And by now, I was drinking behind closed doors and drawn shades and drinking around the clock, and I could not see what was happening to my children. I mean, I couldn't watch it. And so I had to blot it out with more drinks and more pills all the time because I couldn't stand to see it. And somewhere, some day or night, it was all running together by then, you know. It was almost audible. I knew I desperately needed help. It was almost audible. By that time, I was here having audio hallucinations. And God knows I'd been in blackouts for a long time. And I knew I needed help, and I found myself calling the North Hollywood Clubhouse of Alcoholics Anonymous. It took me 2 years on the program to remember where I'd even heard about AA. Then I remembered that I was a drunken brawl across the street, and there was a red-headed woman there drinking a Coke. I hated women, and especially those that didn't drink. And apparently I had asked her why she wasn't drinking, or I don't know. I don't remember the conversation. However, at this time when I was remembering about all this, I remember that she said something to me about having found a better way to live. And she must have said something about AA. And that reminds me that my responsibility is to scatter the seed and not demand that it sprout on the spot. Because I'm sure that that woman does not know to this day that I ever got sober. I don't even know if she stayed sober. But here it was 2 years later that I was calling the North Hollywood Clubhouse of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a young man answered the phone, and he sensed my desperation, and he said, "I'll be right out," which is, you know, kind of an unbroken... he broke one of the unwritten rules, because men are not supposed to call on women. Down there, anyway, I don't think they do up here either. And I thank God because, you know, God in His infinite wisdom sent exactly the right person for me. I don't know whether I'd be ready for a couple of Salvation Sues at that time. But I'll tell you another thing, that if this guy had any romantic inclinations on the way out, when I opened that front door, especially if he was downwind, I'll tell you, because by now I had been inhabiting a dirty moo-moo for about 3-4 months. I don't know how long it was. I hadn't had a bath, and that was too dangerous, by the way. I almost drowned once. I came to, and the water was this far from my nose. Right away, I knew it was too dangerous to do that. But anyway, he opened the door, and he had one of these big AA smiles, and I hated him. And I was drinking out of my cheese glass. I was pouring my vodka and drinking and waiting for him to, you know, to tell me to quit drinking. He never did. So finally I said, "Aren't you going to stop me from drinking?" He said, "No, keep going." Well, God, that got my attention. Nobody had ever told me that before. So, you know, he's talking about AA and the meeting and all this. And he finally decided, he said, let's go out to a meeting. There's one out in Chatsworth, which is way, it was miles and miles out in the boonies. And, hell, I was glad to go, be invited to go anywhere. Nobody had been speaking to me everybody was hanging up on me. Nobody had talked to me. So I said, okay, and I put on my raincoat over my dirty moo-moo. And just before we left, I poured another drink and I said, are you sure it's okay to drink? And he said, sure, go ahead. I said, hell with it. That's the last drink I took. I wasn't an alcoholic. That was March the 29th, 1961. And it hasn't been necessary for me. Wait a minute. It's been necessary. But I've been allowed to stay sober. So anyway, he took me out to this meeting. It was a little tiny meeting, maybe 20 people there. It was a little tiny church building. And I went up to the window and looked in, and I thought, God, it looks like another PTA meeting, and I know I don't fit in there. And I was crazy, and I was drunk, and crying and dying and screaming. And I started to back off. And he said, well, come on over here to the front door and look in. He said, maybe you get a different perspective. And I got over there by the front door, and he took me and he shoved me in. Now, I'd call that promotion rather than attraction. Rule number two he broke. Then he broke rule number three. He said, you're an alcoholic. Well, I welcomed that. That sounded rather scientific to me, that title, compared to what I had been called. So he then introduced me to the woman who was to become my first sponsor. And she represented everything I hated in women. She was soft-spoken, spiritual, well-groomed, cunning, baffling, and powerful. And she spoon-fed my soul, which was the sickest part of me. And I don't know, I don't understand when people say, I can't find a higher power. I found it at that first meeting. That's the only thing I found. I didn't see it. I felt it. The power that's in these rooms, every room I go to like this. The power. The power of unconditional love. My God. God is love. God is love. And for you new people, you may deny everything you hear in these meetings, but you cannot deny what you see and what you feel. And neither could I, and that's why I'm here. Because I can never deny what I feel in this room right now. How could I deny after that meeting where I was so dirty and sick and crazy and screaming? When a man, a little old man that looked like he'd spent the rest of his, most of his life under a bridge, came up to me after the meeting, and I can still see his gnarly little hand over my shoulder. And he kissed me on the cheek. No one had ever done that. No one for such a long time. And that ignited my way to Alcoholics Anonymous. And the next day, I got calls from those people giving me their love, accepting me exactly as I was. My God, where in the world can you buy that with all the money in the world? Nowhere. Nowhere. And so I started going to 10 meetings a week because my sponsor took me home that night. And, you know, in those days, I have to tell you that my respect, I have such a profound respect and love for the old-timers to this day, to this minute. Those old-timers that would not brook any nonsense, that were more interested in my survival than my approval or my friendship, that forced everything on me that I needed to stay sober a day at a time. And she was one of those old-timers. And she said, I will be with, I will pick you up tomorrow night at 8 o'clock, and we're going to a woman's stag. And I almost threw up. Because I was too scared to tell her I hated women. And so it took all the next day for me to... She told me to please bathe. I thought, what the hell do they want from me, these people? And so it took me all day the next day to get ready for that. I was so sick, and every fiber of my being wanted a drink out of that half a bottle that I had left. And I thought, no, they told me not to drink today. And I won't drink today. See, I'd been on the wagon so many times, I knew that booze was not my problem. It was not, because I'd already proven that to myself. And so I went along with it. And so she picked me up the following day. And I went up to this woman's stag, and I knew that I didn't belong there because I was dirty. And I was worse than anybody there. And I knew that, and it was true, because I walked in there and there was a very elegant lady leading that meeting with a long blonde page boy and an expensive black dress with the pearls. And I thought, oh my God, a toast burner. She hasn't been off the block, that one. And I just didn't fit in at all. I didn't fit in. I was not like those women. But I think that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Because the next woman that got up talked in my native tongue, profanity. And I started to get a little hope there. So I was going to 10 meetings a week. And I'll tell you now that those women saved my sanity and my life. See, the men I could always manipulate, and, you know, that was my stock in trade. And I could always con them. But the women will tell you the truth. And they saved my life and my sanity. And I love the women of Alcoholics Anonymous. I really have, I can't even tell you. I get choked up when I think of some of those women that, the things they did to make me whole again. And Johanna talked about being a lady. I don't know that I'm a lady. I would rather be a woman. I think a woman sounds a little more genuine because I tried so hard to be a lady, and it's very difficult when you're falling off the bar stool trying to be that lady. I really like being a woman. And so again, 10 meetings a week, and my husband took a dim view of that. I don't think he wanted me that sober. He got in a rage. He would call me and threatened to take my children, and in his own sickness he threatened to kill me, and it was driving me just crazy. And one day I called my sponsor and I said, I'm going to kill that guy if he comes near me. He's driving me crazy, and it's not that I had any idea of drinking, I just wanted to kill that guy. And you know, I just kept raving at her, and I said, what am I going to do? I can't stand it any longer. She said, hang up. Never occurred to me. But they had to talk to me in very simple, you know, language. I couldn't assimilate more than three words at a time. And so I knew damn well that wasn't going to work. I thought, these people are crazy. They're making me do all the things that are not going to work. And so I knew just about approximately what time he would call. And the next time the phone rang, with my guts churning, I went over to the phone, picked it up, and I said, I'm sorry, but you're upsetting my serenity. And I hung up real fast. I kept doing that. And it started working because he started not calling me anymore. And I kept going to the woman's meetings, and I kept going to those 10 meetings a week. And in the original group that I went to, there was a nucleus of five hard-nosed old-time men. And I mean, they were mean to me, you know that? I don't think they ever said anything to me without prefacing it with, listen, stupid. You know, and they really didn't know how intelligent I was. But then I thought I'll wait and tell them later. But thank God, as I say, thank God for those old-timers, because we weren't asked what we'd like to do. We were told what to do. And it saved my life. That's what it did. Anyway, I went along like this, and about 3 months after I was sober, I got one of those phone calls from my husband again. And he was in a rage, and again, the threats. Again, he was going to take the children. Again, he was going to kill me if he ever found me out on the street. And I went screaming to the woman's stag that night, and all this homicidal rage jumped up in me again, and I was crying and screaming and saying, I can't stand it, and I'm pleading for direction. And you know what that elegant lady said to me? She said, pray for the son of a bitch. And, you know, it's the last thing I wanted to do. Everything's been the last thing I wanted to do, as a matter of fact. So that night at the end of the meeting, during the Lord's Prayer, I prayed for him. I didn't mean a damn word of it. But they told me to do it, so I did it. And it kept going on, and finally everything cooled again, to the point where, you know, my sponsors kept saying, we have to stop fighting everything and everybody. And it says in italics, we have to. But, you know, I come from where you get even. And this is a whole turnaround for me. And so it was going along smoothly, to the point where my husband was able to talk to me in a sensible way, and I with him, and we finally were able to sit down as two human beings and talk about the future of the children and, you know, smooth things over, realize we had a bad marriage and it would never work, et cetera, et cetera. I'm not going to try to tell you that AA put my marriage back together, because it did not. However, around that time, one of the old-timers said to me, don't you think it's about time you made amends to him? And I said, if you say so, Roy. And so, again, the great privilege was given to me of making amends to this man just 2 weeks before he died of a heart attack. And I don't know what would have happened to me had he died when I hated him so much. But see, I was freely given the gift of forgiveness by people who cared about me when I couldn't care about myself. And the morning that I was called and told of his death, I had a feeling of calm acceptance that I had never experienced before in my life. And I guess this is when my never-ending love affair with the people of Alcoholics Anonymous started. Because they came by car, and they came by wire, and they came by card, and they came by phone, and they came every way there was to come. And I was only sober 4.5 months, and I was overwhelmed and sustained because these people were asking what they could do for me, how they could help me, and asking nothing in return. And I was given the words to tell my children, and that was difficult. And so the ensuing years were not easy for me, because at that time we were $13,000 in debt to the IRS. And, you know, you can't file bankruptcy in that. And at that time, we were running a restaurant. And I was told that I had to make financial amends, whether I was entirely to blame or not, by those old-timers up there. And so I ran the restaurant for about a year. And in the meantime, with all these meetings and all these new friends I had, the AA people kept coming in and drinking up all my damn coffee. And I was slowly but surely paying back the IRS. And at the end of that year, I had paid all the bills off. And my lease was up. And by that time, we had 2 or 3 meetings a week going in that place. And so I approached the landlord and asked him if we could turn it into a clubhouse. And he agreed, and that clubhouse started then and is still running today. And it's a crazy place, I'll tell you. But there's a lot of people got sober there. And I can't take any credit for that clubhouse being in existence, because there were a lot of old-timers around there. Eddie was one. And it just evolved, is what happened. It evolved. And so the ensuing years were not easy, because I had 3 little kids and no money. And I was sober about 5 years, and I'd entered into an AA marriage, thinking that AA guarantees peace and tranquility and, you know, happiness ever after. That's what I hoped. But, you know, it never ceases to amaze me how easy it is to get involved in AA and how hard it is to get out of it. it was always easier for me to let go of the guy that I was in love with and the illusion of how it was supposed to be. I had a tough time with that. But that marriage ended after a brief time, but there was a difference this time in that we were both able to walk away without rancor or bitterness or starting a big fight or anything else. It was just one of those things that... And I learned more about me during that marriage than I would have learned otherwise. And so it was necessary for me to get a job, and I got a job in a hospital kitchen for $1.15 an hour. And the most menial job I've ever had in my life. I was cleaning pots and pans and employees' toilets and learning how to be a diet aide and all that stuff. And I hated that job. And my sponsor made me stay there because she said when God was ready to move me, he would move me. And I hated it, and I went every day with my fists clenched, and my I hated that job, but I did it anyway because they told me I had to do what was right in front of me. I'd play the hand that I was dealt today, they told me. And so I look back after that, and that was probably one of the lessons I needed most in my whole life. See, having to work like that changed everything for me on the inside. My values were always based on money, property, and prestige. And you know, I had those things at one time. And I always came up empty. But that job got me down to where it's at. Because it changed my values. I would not, for instance, have had the feelings that I did when I was invited to my oldest son's first football game in high school. He made first string varsity. And I remember going out to that football field. And on the way in, I was thinking, my God, it's a miracle. Here I am. I'm sober and walking in with my head up. And if it wasn't for those people, it could have been so different. If I had shown up in the old days, I would have been drunk and a disgrace and an embarrassment to this kid. But instead, I am privileged. I am allowed to be a part of one of the most important days of his life because of the people who cared about me when I couldn't care about myself. And I walked into that stadium and it went clear to the end zone. And when I was watching those kids warming up out on the field, God, I got so choked up and overwhelmed with emotion that when they called his name over the loudspeaker, I broke down and cried. I just couldn't contain the gratitude that I had. And my second son followed in his footsteps. And I was out there every Friday crying for the same reason. I loved it. I loved to be overwhelmed with gratitude because sometimes, you know, I look around and wonder where it went. But I don't know whether you people know Keith C. You may. You know, he was a football player. There was a time when his son and my son were on opposing teams, and I went out to the game with Keith. And it turned out that my son was guarding his son in the end zone. Do you know that my kid intercepted a pass that was meant for Keith's kid and ran that ball back 65 yards, and I went crazy. I was beating him on the head. Well, it's the first time I wet my pants since I sobered up. Yeah, I could have missed that too, you know. Yeah, it was just fantastic. See, I wouldn't have appreciated any of that stuff if my values were still money, property, and prestige. God, I've got, you know, that kid is made a salesman of the year for an insurance company last year in the whole United States. He has a beautiful home up in Thousand Oaks. He's given me two beautiful grandsons. He has a beautiful spiritual wife. Wonderful life he has. And I tell you, I was speaking up in Oxnard, and I stayed with him overnight, and he drove me to the meeting, and he sat and listened to me for the first time. And when we got back in the car, there was silence for quite a while. And finally that kid said to me, Mother, the next time you talk to those people, you tell them that if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be where I am today. And you know that's the truth. It tore me up. It's the truth. And that's the kid that he and his wife he and his wife decided to remarry, and they became born-again Christians. And I went up to the wedding. And after the wedding, they had the reception in their nice home, and the minister was there and all these other born-again Christians and drinking champagne. And I was sitting in a chair, and he came over and knelt by me and put his hand on my arm, and he said, "Mother, I have to talk to you very seriously." And I said, "What is it, John?" He said, "Mother, you got to be saved." I said, "Jesus, you don't know what it is to be saved." And I remember going to my other son's formal wedding, too, and standing behind those double doors waiting for somebody to come down and drag the old lady up the aisle. You know how they do. And while standing behind those double doors, I'm standing there in this green satin dress and gloves and flowers in my hair, and I'm standing there thinking, "God, you come a long way, baby." Here I am standing here. I knew where I was last night and who I was with and what we did. And I've had a bath. I've got underwear on. And I smell good. All because of those people. And just about that time, the doors opened and they started walking me down the aisle. And my other son gave me a squeeze, and that was a message. And I got up toward the front of the church, and there on the right-hand side were my neighbors. They hadn't seen me for several years. And I saw this look of awe coming. They couldn't believe what they saw. And God, that choked me up. Because by the time I got to AA, none of them were speaking to me, those ladies. I was borrowing their husbands, you know. And when I sat down, I sat in front of my next door neighbor, whose husband was very handsome. Sat in front of her, and she tapped me on the shoulder, and as I turned my head, she kissed my cheek. See, all they wanted was to see me get well, and I didn't know that. I thought they were putting me down all the time. And so it goes. I could spend many more minutes telling you of the fabulous things that have happened to me, none of which are in a material sense, but those things that are much more valuable to me, those things you can't buy with money. And I must also, lest you get the idea that I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and everything turned out beautiful forever and, you know, live happily ever after, I must also share my pain with you. Because my daughter, at the age of 11, picked up her first drink, and another alcoholic was born. And I was to know the sleepless nights, the anguish, the heartbreak, the terrifying fear, and the frustration of having a kid out there on the streets. And I was to experience the police coming to my house and approaching her and using those words I thought I would never hear, "Claudia, you're under arrest." And that went on for several years, and I was to know the going down to police stations and signing APBs, the going to the various juvenile halls to pick her up. And you know, I didn't know that her problem was alcohol or drugs. I could not or did not see that, or refused to believe that was, I thought she was going through a phase. Denial. And so came the time when she reached a crisis in her life, and she wanted out. She wanted by that time I knew that she was alcoholic and using drugs also, and it was precisely at that time that God sent somebody to buy my house. Now, I always say that God's timing is wonderful if you don't mind heart attacks. But it was precisely at that time that I was able, that the bank on the corner wanted my house, and I was able to get the money I asked for without any quibbling or anything, and therefore afforded me the opportunity to take my daughter and move to Honolulu to get away from all those bad people. You know how that is. Hope springs eternal in a mother's heart. And so we went to Honolulu, and I went to work. I became director of a woman's 12-step house down there at St. Francis Hospital in a place that used to be a nunnery. Can you believe that? Me, who hated women, who was passing out in alleys, running a woman's 12-step house in a Catholic hospital that used to be a nunnery. And we went down there, and for a few months, it was okay. But then, you know, it isn't that I didn't trust her or that I don't trust you newcomers. It's that I don't trust our disease. Because soon it was a rerun of the whole thing, and the agony and the heartbreak and the frustration and it driving me up the wall. And I did the only thing that I could do at that time. And I'll never regret it. I joined Al-Anon. And it was because of those Al-Anon people and the love and the support that I got from them and the encouragement and the sharing that I found one day when my daughter came and asked for one more chance that I was able, with the strength that I got from Al-Anon, to take her down to the Honolulu airport. And while she became hysterical and screamed and cried for another chance, I had to shove her on the plane and tell her to get the hell out of my life. And I had to walk away as fast as I could. Because I knew that if I stood there, I didn't have the strength not to take her back. And I went back to the halfway house, and the women were there to support me. The Al-Anon women and the AA women. And so it wasn't until a few months later when my boss suggested that maybe I'd like to have a week's vacation. And, of course, I wanted to go up to the valley where that good AA was and fill my cup again. And I went up to the valley, the San Fernando Valley, where I got sober and visited my home groups. And I walked into a Sunday night meeting. And my daughter was reading chapter 5. And I would like to say to you that from that day to this, she has not had a drink or used any drugs. But that's not the truth. Because after 3 years in our fellowship, she went out again to that never, never land where the days are so dark and the nights are so long and there's no hope anywhere. I had to live on the knowledge that her life was none of my business. And that my life is none of my business either. That's what step 3 tells me. And that's difficult to remember. When you're hearing about the bad checks and the total cars and everything, it's hard. I'm not saying anything is easy. I'm saying it's possible. And I also lived in the knowledge that everywhere in the world, at the conclusion of these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, that over 1 million recovered alcoholics were praying for her and people like her. And I guess that I'm living proof And there are others in here like me. I am living proof that it's possible to stay sober with a broken heart. And so it was a few months ago when I got an early morning call from her, crying, screaming, hysterical, and saying she was going to commit suicide. And I was able to reach into my Al-Anon pocket and say to her, "Claudia, you know where you can get help," and I hung up on her. And God, that was hard for me to do. And you know, she did call Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, the Alcoholics Anonymous people went and picked her up and took her to the hospital and had her stomach pumped and saved her life and took her to a detox center. And I have had to stay out of it totally. I am pleased to announce that before I came up here, she got her 90-day chip without any help from me. And so, the promises once more have been delivered. Everything I have that is of any value at all, anything I hope to be, is the direct result of the people who cared about me when I couldn't care about myself. But most of all, for teaching me to walk in the dignity of sobriety, I want to thank you from the bottom of my heart.